Recent advances in basic and translational sciences offer the promise to develop new types of treatments, new treatment combinations, new modes of administration, and better patient selection. To translate these innovations in the life sciences into tangible patient benefit will, however, require a parallel track of innovation in the tools and methodologies that inform regulatory, reimbursement, and treatment decisions. How can the healthcare ecosystem best support the coevolution of life sciences and methodology innovation? I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor of the DIA Global Forum magazine. I am here with Dr. Hans-Georg Eichler, Senior Medical Officer for the European Medicines Agency. Dr. Eichler serves as co-lead for the DIA 28th Annual Euro Meeting here in Hamburg on the theme of innovation. We are delighted to have this opportunity to discuss innovation and related topics with him. Welcome, Dr. Eichler, and thank you for your time today. My first question is the following. Innovation is generally used to describe scientific or technological progress. But how can we innovate new or improved methods of collaboration between stakeholders in drug development?
So I totally agree with your introductory statement that we live in exciting times, and basic science has the opportunity, and that's also a challenge, to really help patients and address unmet needs in a way that we haven't seen for the past couple of decades. What we are seeing increasingly is maybe that our healthcare ecosystem may not be ready to accept those innovations and to enable the translation to meaningful treatments for patients. So I guess what we need is two parallel tracks of innovation. One is on the product side, on the basic science side, but the other is on the tool side, the methodology side. So to give you an example, I know very well that a lot of members of my own community and in the academic community still think there is only one way to generate evidence, and that is the big randomized controlled trial, and nothing else goes. Well, we will have to revisit that. If we stuck in the past with that methodology, as great as it was, or as great as it is, we will not enable some of the new technologies to come through. Because you cannot run a large randomized controlled trial if you have rare diseases, if you have small treatment eligible populations, if you have multiple combinations of treatments, and that is the future that we are seeing. Another one is that we need to see how we can best harness the potential value of real-world data that is out there. There is lots of debates. We're still finding our own ways. We're on the steep part of the learning curve for that. So how can we get together and say this or that methodology is acceptable as a basis for decision-making, not only for regulators, but also for downstream decision-makers, particularly for payers? What is acceptable? What is not acceptable? We have to get together on that. And another example is the sometimes murky science of biomarker development. So
murky science.
It's murky in the sense that in theory, everything is so clear. You develop your stratification criterion. You say this patient is biomarker positive, this one is negative, therefore this will be the decision rule. That is the theory. What the past has shown us is that it was a little murkier. What we thought was a great stratification criterion later on turned out not to be. For other products, we started broad development until sometimes by serendipity, we found there is a stratification criterion and we could rescue a molecule. So there is this learning by doing, almost necessity, and the various players in the ecosystem will have to get together to see again, how can we enable that and not block development by being purists?
Has the pace of innovation accelerated significantly in the last 10 years in your experience?
That's very difficult to judge when you're in the midst of the development. It's like seeing, does your own child grow? If you see them every day, you think there isn't much movement. But then if you look back at the old photographs, what happened 10 years ago, you see there was a lot of progress. And I would argue, yes, the science of development has progressed a lot. So we now have diseases, and I'm thinking of some of the cancers where today, if you are diagnosed with that disease, you have a so much better prognosis than if you had been diagnosed with the same disease 20 years ago. So I'm very optimistic. Yes, there has been acceleration. Yes, we live in good times for innovation.
From your perspective as a senior medical advisor at the EMA, of course, you deal with a lot of sponsors of many different sizes. So my next question really has to do with what can small startup companies and well-established multinational companies teach one another about innovation, in your observation and experience?
I think there is a two-way street. On the one hand, you've got the flexibility. On the other hand, you have experience. And we see this every day. We talk to the big companies. They have all the experience. They come to us with teams of 10, sometimes 20 people. We call that a big pharma bus, how they come into us. But all the decision-making takes a long, long time. So we see how they are a bit inflexible. But in the end, they usually address the questions. When we talk to the small companies, it's the exact opposite. Lots of enthusiasm. Things can move fast, but they don't have experience. So should there be an interaction between those two? It would be ideal. We analyzed a couple of years ago, where does the innovation come from that we authorize? We published that even. So we looked at a sample of a couple of dozen of products that made it. We authorized them. And we looked back in history, where did they originate? And more than a third originated not in big company research, in big company research labs, but they came from academics, very small groups. And our goal is to help those small groups to make it through the valley of death, so to speak. And maybe our definition of a valley of death is somewhat different than from the investor point of view. To make it through that so that we have meaningful innovation for patients.
And how are you as an agency promoting this outreach and this help to small companies and academics?
Many years ago, and you caught me on the wrong foot, I couldn't tell you when, but it's at least 10 years ago, that we set up a dedicated SME office. SME in Europe means small and medium enterprise. And that is dedicated to reaching out to exactly those small businesses that don't have the experience, that need a little extra help from the regulator. And we take them by the hand, and we hope to help be helpful in leading them through. This is not about different evidence standards for them. No, but this is about more procedural guidance help to say, look, maybe the next thing you want to do is this or that. And very recently, we have unveiled the so-called Prime Initiative at the EMA, and there was a bit of debate because we had started, and we stuck by that, to give preferential treatment to small companies. And that is now instituted again. And some of the big farmers were a bit annoyed and said, why are you being unfair? And in fact, yes, in a way, you could call that unfair. But we wanted to reach out to the small companies because we know that if we don't, some of the potentially valuable products may not come through. So that is why we now accept applications for the prime pathway from SMEs at a different stage of development than we would from other players, i.e. big pharma.
And what preferential treatment are you affording? Is this an example? Are there more aspects of this preferential treatment for SMEs?
So the prime is a pathway where we give a lot of support to companies. And the differential treatment between the small and the big is not about evidence standards. That would be unacceptable, irresponsible. But we allow them in at an earlier stage than we would allow in and start the process than we would allow for the big pharma companies. And again, that is because we know if we don't do it, some of the products might fail.
Are there any commonalities or parallels between PRIME, as you've described it, and as it exists in Europe, compared to the breakthrough therapy designation at FDA or the Sakigake program in Japan?
These are different processes that operate in different legal and societal environments. But having said that, all these initiatives that you mentioned have one thing in common, and that is we want to achieve timely access for those patients who are in need today. So in that sense, yes, absolutely, there are many parallels.
Another question, if I may. The divide between clinical research and the clinical practice of medicine has been identified as one of the most critical needs facing the clinical research enterprise today. So the question is, how can we effectively bridge this gap?
This divide between research setting and clinical setting, to me, it has two aspects. One is about honesty vis-a-vis patients. If you are a patient in a clinical trial, you have to consent, there is information, there's a very specific track how you are treated that is separate and different from clinical routine. But think about it. The next morning, that product is authorized and everything is becoming routine. The informed consent disappears, everything disappears. Now, do we really know so much more about a product on the next morning than we did on the evening before authorization? Or in other words, the last patient who was enrolled in a pre-launch trial, is that so different from the first patient who gets it once the product is on the market? I would argue, no, there isn't. And yet we have this magic moment, this huge divide between pre and post. Whereas in reality, evidence generation is a continuum. And we shouldn't fool ourselves. Of course, we want to learn from those patients who are treated so-called routine conditions immediately after launch. And I think this is a laudable and very valuable activity, and we have to be honest about that. So maybe that artificial divide between the research setting and the clinical routine setting, maybe in future we have to find ways, ethical ways, legal ways, to sort of blur that to reflect reality. So that's one thing. That is the ethical dimension. The other is, what can the product do? And we all know what we call what a product can do in the research setting, efficacy, and then what happens out in real life, effectiveness. And there is this well-known and well-described efficacy-effectiveness gap. Usually, products work better, perform better in the artificial research setting than they do in the clinical routine setting. And there are calls for more pragmatic trials so as to have a better prediction of what will happen. That's all very good. But I think where we're falling short is that maybe we should bring up reality to the clinical research reality. Because if a product can do something, if used under best circumstances, why are we satisfied to see it perform less well because it is not used in an optimal way? So to me, it is not just that the expectations of research should be lowered, but maybe the performance criteria of the real-world prescribing situation should be improved.
Is there an inherent source of this gap, and that is patients that participate in clinical trials are highly selected on the basis of very specific inclusion criteria and exclusion criteria, whereas, as you say, in routine practice, those criteria sort of go away, and patients are less carefully scrutinized, perhaps, before being administered a newly approved medicine?
So what you describe is clearly one source, and we know that, of the efficacy-effectiveness gap. Because we have these confounder-cleansed patients in the research setting, and of course, once it goes out, the variability across patients who are treated in real life is much bigger than it is in the research setting. But I would think that is one, and maybe a very important source of the efficacy-effectiveness gap, but there are other sources. Just think of adherence. If you're a patient in a clinical trial, or I was a clinical trial physician, we had nurses who would phone patients and say, have you taken your tablets today? That does not happen if I'm a patient in real life. So what you see is low adherence, discontinuation, patients who should take their products for a lifetime, stop after 6 months. We know all of that. There's no secrets here. We know that sometimes physicians prescribe in a way that is less, shall we say, than optimal. Of course, we know that there are these contraindications are overlooked, and then therapeutic misadventures happen. So to me, that efficacy-effectiveness gap is a very multifactorial issue that will require many strands of activity to come to grips with it.
Extremely interesting and clearly work in progress. We're not quite there yet.
Absolutely.
But that was my last question. Thank you, Dr. Eichler, for being with us today and for speaking with DAA Global Forum.
Pleasure.